is the Valley of Dry Bones. And it's found in Ezekiel, the 37th chapter, the first 14 verses. And I think it would get our minds well set on the subject if we read that passage together, and then we'll consider some of the words that are spoken. And we'll share this reading responsibility around, and then we'll start commenting on these verses. So we'll ask, we'll turn to Ezekiel 37. Ask Sister Edna to read the first 5 verses. Sister Clara to read through verse 10, and Linda to finish through verse 14. There's a vision that we don't need to guess at the interpretation, because the Lord gives us the interpretation right following the vision. It's an unusual vision in a way, because he takes into this valley, and the valley is full of bones. And the bones are completely disconnected. We don't have the hip bone connected to the thigh bone, but you have them all totally separate. He walks around the whole valley. So it's taken walking to us. And then he's asked the question, do you really think that these bones can live? And I have to give Ezekiel a lot of credit. I think if I were there, if you were there, forget it. They're in complete shambles. There's no way. But Ezekiel says, you know, Lord. That could be taken 2 ways. You know, Lord, they can't. But more likely, Lord, if you want it, you can. And the Lord said, okay, if you have enough faith to ask if I can, then prophesy that they will. Well, I think a little bit further. There's one thing to say, Lord, I think you can do it. There's another thing to make a big point out of it and get up and prophesy, these bones will live. They're going to have not only come together, miraculously flesh and sinew and skin and breath's going to go into them, and they're going to become a great nation out of this valley of discarded bones. But as a result of the prophecy, the bones came together. Eventually life enters into them and they live. And then the Lord tells him the meaning, that these bones are the hopes of Israel. So the prophecy has to do with the restoration of the dried out hope of Israel. Now there are 2 things we'd like to notice. First thing we want to notice is the process by which the bones come together. And we'll notice as we look at it that they come together, or that the entire transformation of these isolated, separated, dried up bones to living human beings takes place in various stages. The first thing that happens, you have the gathering of the bones. Okay, one thing to have a valley full of isolated dried bones. It's another thing to have a valley full of skeletons. That's what you come to when you put these bones together. You have just skeletal frames. So then the second project that the Lord does is he adds in this order flesh and sinew. He's sort of giving him a lesson in anatomy, how to make a body. You start out with a bone structure, and then you add to it flesh, you add to it sinew. But still, it's a pretty bloody looking mess, because you've got nothing covered. You've got just this raw flesh and sinew there. So then he goes to the third step. Yeah. Puts a covering of skin over these bones. Now at least they look like people. You've got not just a valley full of meat, but you've got actual people there. Except for one thing. They're all dead. Now they need one more element to put them together. We're going to leave a little space here. That element is breath. When you add the element of breath to a formed body, you have, well, what's the formula of Genesis 2:7? God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living soul.
And so the same formula is repeated here.
So the first thing that we notice is
there are an order to the
way in which he creates from the miscellaneous bones an actual living nation. Now the second thing we want to notice is that there are certain cause-effect relationships in this prophecy. It isn't a case where Ezekiel just stands back and he watches this whole thing happen. Today, in the use of the media, they tell us that one of the most important things is to make your audience a part of the action, to have audience involvement. God wasn't behind the times at all. He gave Ezekiel a part in this movie, a part of this vision. He said, okay, you saw those bones, Ezekiel? Do something about it. You prophesy. I'm not going to do a thing until you prophesy. That's what he tells us in that first part. We come down to verses 3 and 4. He said, Son of man, which is Ezekiel, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Again he said to me, prophesy to these bones, and say to them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Coming on down to verse 7. So I prophesied, and as I prophesied, there was a noise. And the whole event takes place. The trigger reaction to start these bones was the prophecy of Ezekiel. So we'll go here. Before the first part, Ezekiel prophesied. Okay. Now, that seemingly is a clear procedure we've got. Ezekiel prophesied, the bones are gathered, flesh and sinew, skin, breath. But it doesn't work that way. As you read through here, Ezekiel prophesied, and you don't have a complete chain reaction. You have a chain reaction that grinds to a halt. Where does it stop? Let's note again our scripture. Verse 7, I prophesied as I was commanded. As I was prophesied, there was a shaking and this noise. The bones come together. Verse 8, the skin and the flesh and the skin. But there was no breath. Then said he unto me, prophesy. And then, verse 10, so I prophesied, and the breath comes. The chain reaction of Ezekiel's prophecy, his participation in this vision, does not stop with his initial prophecy. That only brings it down to the place of skin. Ezekiel's second prophecy is why we left space here. Okay. So now we have our complete order of the vision. The prophecy of Ezekiel, the gathering of the bones, the flesh and the sinew of the skin, the second prophecy, and then the breath enters. Now, noticing this, let's skip over to another column and notice what has happened in point of historical fact in the regathering of Israel. We'll tie these two together shortly. We want to notice that the nation of Israel, which entered its diaspora, the scattering among the nations, in 606 B.C., which was cast off by the Lord in 33 A.D., which went through the destruction of their temple in 70 A.D., which was completely driven from the land of Palestine in 135 A.D., that this nation, from 135 until the late 1700s, lies a completely neglected, cursed, and persecuted people by all the nations of the earth. In the very early 1800s, 1801, 1802, there is a very temporary bringing them back to a equality basis out of second-rate citizenship in just one country, when Napoleon grants recognition to the Jews in France. But that doesn't last long. Because then in 1803 or 4, Napoleon again brings papacy back into favor in France, and the Jews go back out.
So that was just a 1 or 2 year little breather that comes in. Then they stay out of favor until you have the first significant turning point, which was the Turco-Russian War that took place starting in 1876. War wasn't over Israel at all. It was over Palestine, yes. Palestine was very much involved. The full control of the Middle East was involved. It was a war that had to end at a treaty conference. The war that was not that decisive for either side. This treaty conference, called the Berlin Congress of Nations, was held in 1878, and out of this conference came the treaty. This treaty does not even mention the word Israel, does not even mention the word Jews. The treaty has to do strictly with the territorial control of the Middle East. And this territorial control is put into, I believe it was the hands of England at the time. I may be wrong on that. I've got to go back and check that fact. But it was at least delegated where the control would be of the Middle East. And a stipulation was made that the Middle East would be internationalized. Now that meant this. That no longer could any nation so control that land that they could prohibit any other people from owning land in the Middle East. As a result, many people began to purchase land and make investments in the Middle East area, if you will. But coincident, time-wise, with this was a persecution by the Russians of the Jewish population in the southern part of Russia, Georgia, that area through there. As a result of this, there was a evacuation, that's the word to use, there was an exodus, that's a better word, of many of the Jews from southern Russia to Palestine, and they could go there that year because the treaty had said that anyone could go. It didn't say Jews could go, it said anyone. Well, Jews happened to be included in anyone. And so they went, they bought a piece of land not far from the present city of Tel Aviv, and they named this piece of land, in our language, the Door of Hope. It was a door of hope of entering this land. In their language, it was named Petah Tikva, and remains that name to this day. So your first significant date was 1878. Other colonies began. And by 1889, there were 8 Jewish colonies in Palestine. These colonies went bankrupt, all 8 of them. The Jews were going to be forced to leave the Holy Land. There was no way they could stay because they couldn't meet the mortgage payments on the land. They couldn't meet the payments of the salaries needed. The land was not producing. It was not fruitful. And again, the whole thing was about to be aborted, except for 2 people. 2 people who happened to have billions in the bank. And those were Baron Rothschild and Moses de Montefiore. Rothschild, I believe, his house was basically situated in Paris. Montefiore was in Holland. These 2 men began investing a vast fortune to save these 8 Israeli agricultural communities. As a result, they did not go down at that time. Then you come along to the next significant development, which is 1896. In 1896, the thing that happened of such great importance was a journalist in Vienna, Austria, began to promulgate the concept of a Jewish national state in Palestine. And where this had been promulgated by other isolated Jews before, no one was able to put it all together with both the logic behind it and the charisma to grab the Jewish movement and the Jewish people in the way that this journalist was. This journalist's name was Theodor Herzl. Herzl started in 1896 and called a World Conference of Jews to be held in Vienna, Austria, and this was the conference of Zionism. Zionism was purely a political movement. It was a movement for one purpose,
to establish a political homeland for Israel in Palestine. As a result, the Jews began getting behind this movement, trying to get this going. A rather interesting development at about this time, I believe a little bit earlier, I think it was 1891, even earlier than that, 1889 probably, right in the years before this, there was another interesting, not significant development, but significant only as it shows the importance of 1878. A group of Jews and Christians met together in the city of Chicago, and they formulated a petition. They were headed by a rich hotel magnate in Chicago, Mr. Blackstone. Blackstone Hotel is still there. And they formulated a petition to President Benjamin Harrison, United States, asking President Harrison to call a conference of all the nations of the world to try to establish a Jewish homeland for the Israelis in Palestine. The interesting thing in the petition formulated at that Chicago conference was the legal basis they used to try to persuade the President of the United States to get behind them. They said, after all, the right of the Jews to return to their land was guaranteed by the Berlin Congress of Nations. That was the legal basis that Blackstone used, and that's the only significance of the Blackstone petition, because it came to naught. Nothing happened. From 1896, the next significant development we want to talk about is 1914. 1914, of course, was the First World War. No direct bearing on the Jewish question as such, except as it started again a chain reaction which was of tremendous benefit to Israel. The chain reaction takes place in Great Britain. Britain, of course, was very greatly involved in the war, and they were at the place where their back was getting to be against the wall, a place where they were not coming out victorious in the earlier days of the war. What they lacked, basically, was the ability to make munitions on an economical and large-scale basis. And they put out a tremendous offer to any of their chemists, any of the research men, who could ever come up with the proper formula to produce explosives and gunpowder economically, and there would be a great reward. A Jewish chemist by the name of Chaim Weizmann developed, it wasn't TNT, but it had to do with the production of it, I forget exactly what the development was, that really saved the British war effort. As a result, Weizmann was given the option to have the reward for claiming it. Weizmann said, I don't want a reward. I don't need further money. I don't desire money. What I do desire is a paper from Her Majesty's government that will give a legal favoring of the great nation of Britain to the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And as a result of that, in 1917, Lord Balfour drew up what has come to be known as the Balfour Declaration, placing Her Majesty's government of England on the side of Israel in the establishment of the Jewish homeland. But, again, he came to a place where the events of the following years greatly reversed Great Britain's position. And Britain was in a position where they said, we don't want particularly the homeland of Israel there. We want to keep a balance in the Middle East. Yes, a certain number of Jews and a certain number of Arabs, and keep the two in an equitable balance. And as Zionism pushed forward with immigration of Jews, it put Britain in the place where she put out a white paper rescinding the Balfour Declaration that she had originally made. And, of course, anyone who's read the book or seen the movie The Exodus can see how Britain eventually became almost on the side of opposing the development of the Jewish entry into Palestine. But the Balfour Declaration assumes a tremendous importance in the development because, as you'll see later, it becomes a legal document that is used by the Jewish statesmen to show that here is a document once made that cannot be rescinded and was the legal basis for the establishment of the nation in 48. The next development we want to cover, we're skipping a lot of developments in here. The next development we want to talk about is 1933 to 1939. And this, of course, is the seemingly extremely unfavorable development of the rise of Nazism in Germany and the coincident rise of persecutions upon the Jews. The concept of genocide, wiping out an entire race to preserve the pure Aryan stock, so to speak. This, of course, was one of the factors, certainly not the initial factor, but one of the factors leading into the Great World War of 1939 to 1945, the Second World War. We're bracketing this together because the one is a cause-effect relationship, partially, although there are many other causes that are involved. We're oversimplifying for the purpose of our subject. But now you have here a development and a war which, in a way, is very detrimental to the Jewish cause. But it has three effects. First, in the early phases of this, when the persecution began, it had the effect of forcing many Jews to realize we have to get out. And it created a large-scale exodus to Israel. By 39, the door is closed to get out, except that some are smuggled out through various religious organizations and other political organizations, but you don't have as large a scale because now the war is going on a full scope. But the second effect was they created a condition of world sympathy. For the Jewish cause. The third thing was a psychological thing. It pointed out to the Jews throughout the world, those that were not directly involved in this persecution, that the only way that we as Jewish people will have safety is to have a country of our own. Unfortunately, it had another side effect. It also pointed out that too many of them don't trust in God. He let us down. He let us be slaughtered. But the effect that we're going to speak on now, the other I think is also shown in Scripture, but the one we're going to speak on now is the one of the cause to go back to Israel attitude. These three factors, the increased exodus to Israel, world sympathy for Israel, and the attitude of the Jews throughout the world that Israel needs a homeland, brings us to our next important development in Israel, which is 1948. And of course, this development could not take place without all of the factors before. It is the logical outgrowth of these factors. The right to return to the homeland, Zionism pushing this, the Balfour Declaration setting a legal background, and the events of 33 to 45 making it a practical possibility among the other nations of the world, leads to the formation of the state. Then, of course, you've got your period from 1948 to the present that is developmental, a period that has gone through the three wars, the wars of 48, 56, and 57, and now the Yom Kippur War of 73, all strengthening the role of Israel in their land, and at the same time bringing to the fore their feeling that we can conquer, we don't need anybody. This is a feeling of immense national pride that from all worldly scales is well justified. From Scripture say it was not. But from the standpoint of the politics of the world, it would be a scale that is very easy to understand. And of course, we can see what it lacks. Yes, we have a question mark date on the New Covenant. It is made with Israel. As a result of God fighting for Israel in the last great battle against them. Okay, this is the second thing we want to look at, is the historical development. Now we'd like to try to coordinate these two columns. To notice how when the dry bones are prophesied. It is a prophecy not just in general of the reestablishment of Israel, but a prophecy that's just amazing in its real significance, in the fact that it is very specific in the phase of the development. First, there is the gathering of the bones. Now, 1878, in addition to the Berlin Congress, there's another name that is used for this period. It's usually applied to 1881 in Jewish history books, although Ben-Gurion applies it to 1878. He's the only Jewish writer I know to apply it as early as 78. This period is called, I'll come down here, give myself room, the first Aliyah. Now, Aliyah merely means Exodus. The first input of Jews to the Holy Land. You had several waves of these Aliyahs, of the Jews returning in droves. So we find that the beginning, the gathering of the bones, begins in a way in 1878 as a result of necessity. Persecution has forced them to come back. They've exiled from where they were. The land was opened by the Lord. They come back in. So we have the beginning of a gathering process. But now we come to the next development, flesh. Now, flesh and sinew are very closely related, but they are different. Your sinew has relation particularly to the muscle structure. But usually flesh, you apply to muscles also, to the muscle of an animal. But the word for flesh here appears to be a word that is referring more to the fatty flesh, to the bark covering, the fat bark covering. So you've got a flesh and a sinew. In basic relationship, you expect to put the sinew on first. But the scriptures list it this way, flesh and sinew. And I think it fits well this way. When you come to fat in the scriptures, remember this in Tabernacle of Shadows. The fat of the bullock was burnt on the brazen altar, showing what? Zeal. The zeal of thine house has consumed me. That which eats it up. You need for this regathering of Israel, you need an input of a missionary zeal to bring the people together, to convince them to go back. That's our next development. 1896, isn't it? Zionism. That was its purpose. That was Herzl's goal, was to convince the Jewish community to get behind this movement to return. So you've got flesh going on from 1896. But Herzl, while getting the Jewish people to want to go back, there was no muscle. There was no ability to put this into practice. It was a vision. It was talked up. World conferences were held. They petitioned government. But they were powerless, except as they had the influence of money behind them. But they had no political basis of power to go back. That is what the Balfour Declaration came out. So by 1917, you have sinew. You have strength to this idea of going back. You have the concept now that we can return, we have a legal basis to return, we have one of the most powerful nations of the earth at that time supporting our return. They were ready to move in. They still didn't look like a nation. They still looked like a motley group of people that were coming from various places and building isolated agricultural communities in one corner of the earth. That was about as far as they had gotten. What needed now was to give them the appearance of manhood. And that appearance, the skin gives them in 1948 with the establishment of the nation. Now they look like one of the rest of the family of nations. They look just like another nation. They're tied very much in with the nation. They become part of the United Nations. They are immediately recognized by the United States and by several others. And soon they get as much recognition as almost any other new nation gets on the face of the earth. But much as they look like a nation, they aren't a nation in God's eyes. Because from the Lord's standpoint, the one thing they lack is His Spirit. They are not moving by His Spirit. They are moving in the strength of their military power. They are moving in the strength of, they can lick anyone who comes against them. And the three last wars have shown that they can do a pretty good job. Well, they got surprised in Yom Kippur, But they came back. And the war had to be cut off by Kissinger before Israel got too far, because they were on the victory trail by the time that the pattern was cut short. So they lacked the one thing of the new covenant, God's Spirit going into them. That's your breath. So our formation then, from the Valley of Dry Bones, parallels beautifully what we see historically involved in the development of Israel. But I wanted to notice, as I mentioned before, that Israel was in Israel. Ezekiel 37 is an audience participation drama. These things did not just happen. Ezekiel was given a part in this. His part was, prophesy, thou son of man, and these things will happen. What would happen if he hadn't prophesied? Maybe it would have happened. We don't know. He did prophesy. He carried through on what the Lord told him. Now, any words Ezekiel said could not have, in fact, caused all those things to happen. In fact, they could not have a bearing. It was only as the Lord permitted his operations to be delayed, pending this prophecy, that it had an effect. Certainly you could not establish a scientific cause-effect relationship between somebody speaking and a bunch of bones getting together and getting life. So there's no way you can link the two in a cause-effect scientific relationship. But the Lord is giving us a relationship as it were by giving us this order. Now it's interesting to note, when he gives this prophecy, verses 7, so I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I prophesied, there was a noise, and behold, a shaking, etc. He does not say, I prophesied, and when I finished my prophecy, there was a shaking and noise. The two were going on simultaneously. As he prophesied, this was going on. This prophecy, we think, is the prophecy of the harvest message. Which goes forth simultaneously with this development, prophesying that there would be this regathering of Israel. Is there a cause-effect relationship? And let's say yes and no. I think we can argue both sides. Just as we can in the literal story that's there. We don't know whether those bones would have come together if Ezekiel hadn't prophesied. Fortunately, Ezekiel did. We don't know whether this would have happened if there had not been a harvest message. Fortunately, there was a harvest message. We do know there was no scientific cause-effect relationship between Ezekiel prophesying and those bones coming together. So there is no direct cause-effect relationship between the harvest and this happening. It is not a case that the harvest message causes this, but the Lord holds back the stream of events until the harvest message begins. Now, there's a parallel for this. In Jeremiah, the 25th chapter, I just want to show the same type of relationship. Jeremiah 25:15. Thus says the Lord God of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink, and they shall drink and be moved and be mad, and because of the sword that I will send upon them. Again, took I the cup at the Lord's hand, and I made all the nations to drink, unto whom the Lord has sent me, to wit, Jerusalem, the cities of Judah, and all the kings thereof, and the princes thereof, to make them a desolation, an astonishment, kissing, and a curse, as it is this day, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his servants, and his principals, and all his people, and all the mingled peoples, and all the kings of the land of Uz, and all the kings of the land of the Philistines, Ashkelon, Azah, Ekron, the remnant of Ashdod, Edom, Moab, the children of Ammon, all the kings of Tyrus, all the kings of Zidon, of the kings of the isles which are beyond the sea, Dedan, Teman, Buz, all that are in the utmost corners, all the corners of Arabia, all the kings of the mingled people that dwell in the desert, all the kings of Zimri, all the kings of Elam, all the kings of the Medes, and all the kings of the north, far and near, one another, all the kings of the world, which are upon the face of the earth, which to be sure includes everybody, and the king of Shishak shall drink after them. He'll stop there. That's what Jeremiah was told to do. He was told to make sure that every nation on the face of earth drank the wine and wrath of God. You know where he spent that time? In prison. He didn't go anywhere. But he says, going back to verse 17, then took I the cup of the Lord's hand, and I made all the nations drink. He doesn't do any such thing. He just stays in prison and prophesies that it will happen. But he's given credit for making it happen, even though he didn't have a bit of part other than saying it would happen. Got the same thing in Jeremiah 1. Verses 9 and 10. Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth. And the Lord said unto me, behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to pull down, to destroy, to throw down, and to build and to plant. Jeremiah doesn't do any such thing. All Jeremiah does is prophesy that these things will happen. And the Lord says, you have done it. And so in the same relationship, the prophecy of the development of Israel is a necessary prerequisite to the development. Wow. I think the why is very easy to understand. Because it is God's work. Without the prophecy and only the development, it could always be said, look what man did. It's the prophecy that identifies ahead of time that man will do this, showing that when man does it, it is only because God is permitting him to do it. This is the necessity for this prophecy preceding. Now this prophecy reaches a certain focal height, and it's interesting to know when it reaches these heights. Immediately in the harvest message, in the very first years, in the very first book, which is put out preceding to 1878 and 1877, the book The Three Worlds, it is predicted that Israel will eventually return to its homeland and be the favored nation of God, just preceding the gathering of the bones. It's interesting that just 7 years preceding the Zionist movement, you have your next major prophecy regarding Israel, the third volume of the Restoration of Israel chapter, and its outlining of these events, and it's followed by the flesh going on. Then you come along, and the next major prophecy that is given are the events of 1910 and 1911, beginning with the message in Cincinnati, Ohio, of Pastor Russell on Zionism and prophecy, going to the Hippodrome meeting in New York in the fall of 1910, when the Jews themselves asked Charles Russell, as the first time they approached a Christian, to address their mass rally, to give them the impetus, out of which he becomes declared number two on a roll in Israel as the Friends of Israel, one of the those recognized by Israel as a Gentile friend of the country. Immediately following that, you have the publication and a multi-million scope of the newspaper in Yiddish, Yeshima, The Voice, the same Hippodrome message by Pastor Russell in a tract newspaper form. You have a tremendous outputting of that message preceding the war. Again, it dies down. The emphasis on Jewish prophecy becomes very much put under the other aspects of the message, just preceding the next development in Israel. Then you have, of course, the development of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society and the Judge Rutherford, out of which comes one of the cardinal principles that Jewish prophecies do not apply to Israel at all. They apply to the great others, and Israel becomes cast out of the picture. Then you have the formation of the early days of the Dawn Movement. And it's interesting that the second public witness publication that they put out, written by Brother Hudgings, was the book Zionism and Prophecy. It was done and distributed through non-truth channels. It was distributed by the Jews, among the Jews. And you have this going out from 1934. I believe the last publication of that went out in 1941 or 42, right during your period of your next development in Israel. This leads up, of course, to the sketch. Now, it's interesting that we come to this prophecy that there is no breath going into these bones until Ezekiel takes his next step. Ezekiel has to once again prophesy. And this is in verse 10. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they lived and stood upon their feet, an exceeding great army. So, seemingly, there has to be another prophecy regarding this activity of the Lord before the breath comes in. But this is a prophecy really different. This is not another prophecy to Israel. The others have been prophecies to Israel. Go back and look into verse 4. Note the former prophecy. He said unto me, prophesy upon these bones, and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. The prophecy that is given here, that triggers steps 1, 2, and 3, is a prophecy that is given to the bones. Bones, hear the word of the Lord. But now look down at verse 9. Then said he unto me, prophesy unto the wind, prophesy, son of man, and say to the wind, thus saith the Lord God, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded, and the breath came unto me, and they lived and stood upon their feet, an exceeding great army. The second prophecy is to the wind. What does it mean? What does it mean to prophesy unto the wind? I'd like to look at that verse 9 carefully. What does he tell the wind? Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these flames, that they may live. What are the four winds? There are 8 winds in the Bible, so they say. In Daniel, the 7th chapter, you've got 4 winds. Daniel 7, 1 and 2. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then wrote he the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea, and 4 beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. Okay. Daniel 7. Four winds of heaven. Now let's look at a different 7th chapter. Revelation chapter 7. And after these things I saw 4 angels standing on the 4 corners of the earth, holding the 4 winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. Revelation 7. 4 winds of the earth. What is the difference between the 4 winds of heaven and the 4 winds of earth? We need to establish this if we can determine which 4 winds are in Ezekiel 37. Or we got 12 winds. We got 4 winds that are neuter, neither heaven nor earth. It suggests that the 4 winds of heaven, and you know, it's a little paradoxical to know, that in Daniel 7, the 4 winds of heaven create the 4 great beasts of earth. In Revelation 7, the 4 winds of earth are held back to the heavenly classes complete. So you have an inverse relationship in the two prophecies, but that's sort of a side study. Coming back to these 4 winds, it suggests that the 4 winds of heaven picture the 4 attributes of God. These are the 4 controlling forces in the heavens. And it's these 4 attributes that permitted man and that brought upon man these 4 governments, the times of the Gentiles, to show unto man their complete inability to rule. The 4 winds of earth are the powers of earth, whether they be in the political, the social, the religious, or the economic phase of society. You have four basic phases of mankind's society. Which are we referred to here? I would suggest, and I admit I can't prove this, because this prophecy in Ezekiel can be understood with either set of four winds. But I would suggest by the fact that we are to prophesy under the wind, that he's talking about the four winds of earth. That he's talking about the troubles that are going on in these four sections of society. Because it's interesting to note the relationship these four winds have to Israel. We notice in Revelation 7 that these four winds are in the four corners of the earth. If we look at those four sections of society, we find in economics what? A tremendous battle between capital and labor. Capital labor conflict. Where? Every place. Throughout the world. But where is it centered? Right here in the United States. This is the center of the industrial community, therefore it's the center of capital labor. Just by very virtue of the economy that we live in. You look in the social world. Again, a great worldwide conflict between races, especially between black and white. We've got plenty of it in the United States. But if you think we've got it, go down to South Africa. And you get to the apartheid situation. And you come to its greatest down in the South. Not just southern part of America, but South Africa. And the rebellions that are fomenting so much that anybody who holds a South African passport is not welcome in half the nations of the world. Because of the conflict being that great. Go to the political spectrum. You've got a great conflict there politically between the forces of colonialism and the powers of the emerging nations. Emerging nations do what? To show their independence. They go to the great father of emerging nations, the Soviet Union. The great champion of the emerging nations that wants them in their own sphere. And so you have the East being the symbol of the emerging nations coming up, demanding their place in the sun. Communism versus capitalism. Come to the fourth segment, religion, and you've got a tremendous conflict going on between clergy and laity. Between the authority of the priesthood, the authority of the minister, was the laity. It used to be, in Catholicism, the Pope said, and it was done. Now the Pope says, thou shalt have no birth control, and the laity says, what did you say? No, there's no longer a listening ear. There is an independent action throughout the world, but where? Particularly in Europe. More so than any place else. Italy is your prime example, where you have the country that was the heart of Catholicism that is now the country that has the fastest turnover rate to communism and atheism of any nation in the world. Poland, the Polish country, which is so strongly Catholic, is now one of the strong countries within the communist bloc, although maintaining a certain amount of religious freedom within them. So here you've got four great winds located where? The four corners of the earth. One in the east, the political. One in the west, the religious. One in the south, the social. One in the north, the religious. Let them all blow. You create a whirlwind. Where is the eye of the whirlwind? Israel. Right there. Right where these dry bones look like they're an ancient. They got skin on them. They're ready to breathe. But they lack one thing. The humility necessary to breathe in the Spirit of God. It takes humility, the first skin breath. The first breath is not an outgoing breath. I will do it. It's an intake. They must first take in the Spirit. So it says before that, there is to be a prophecy to or upon the four winds concerning the time of trouble. But the prophecy does not say to the four winds, oh, you winds, blow. It does not say, you winds, hit Israel and knock it down. No, the prophecy is to a fifth wind. Notice the wording. Prophesy to the wind. Say, come from the four winds. Not to one of the four, but it's to the fifth wind. The fifth wind is the Spirit of the Lord. They come out from this time of Jacob's trouble. May the Spirit come from this time of trouble and breathe upon Israel. Well, how can we if we are the Ezekiel class, prophesy to the Spirit of the Lord. I think that's the final practical question that needs to be answered. And I think in a very real way, we cannot. There is no real way we can prophesy to Him. What does prophecy mean? Doesn't prophecy mean speak? Speak out. Speak out through this way. And could not this prophecy be the united prayer of the Ezekiel class for God's breath to come upon Israel? It is not speaking so much here of a public proclamation as it is speaking, as the psalmist puts it, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. An ardent desire that as the four winds blow upon Israel, that from those four winds will come the Spirit of God into these dry bones to make this, what looks like a man, what looks like a nation, act like a nation under God. A prophecy to the people of Israel, yes. To the people of Israel that they open their hearts to the wind when it comes. A prophecy to the people to turn their minds to the word of the Lord and back to the laws of the Old Testament. The message that God has given His church for Israel. Now, if we look at this to a close, is in Isaiah the 40th chapter. And this message covers both this prophecy, and it covers this prayer with the implication of this prayer, which is to tell Israel to accept that wind as it comes. Too frequently, we look at Isaiah 40, and we say that the message to Israel, the prophecy of Ezekiel class, so to speak, is Isaiah 40, 1 and 2. And we don't think that's quite right. We think that the message to Ezekiel is basically verses 1 to 8, and goes beyond that. So starting with 1 and 2. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem. Other translations put that even better. Speak ye to the heart of Jerusalem. Cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Notice the relationship of those two verses to everything leading up to this. And he's telling us that the message is to tell Israel that her warfare, that's her forced servitude, her period of being under the Gentiles is over. Tell her that period in the past. That's comforting. Cry unto her that her iniquity is pardoned. So to tell someone their iniquity is pardoned is to admit they had iniquity. It is not to whitewash Israel, but to say, okay, the sins of the past are covered. That is over. You have paid for this. That's what it says. Because she has received of the Lord's hand a double, 33 to 1878, for all of these sins. But now, we come to the second prophecy. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, repair ye the way of the Lord. Wait a minute. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness. Who is this one crying in the wilderness? John the Baptist. And John said he was this voice. But you remember what Jesus said about John. This is Elijah, if you can receive it. But the full Elijah is Jesus. Applying to who? It's your church. In the flesh, at this end of the age. So to the true church is now the voice of him that cries on the wilderness. To whom are they crying? To Israel, to Jerusalem. What are they crying to Jerusalem? Prepare ye the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. It's telling Israel to prepare for their role in the kingdom. It's telling her to develop that humility necessary to receive the wind, to receive the breath of the Lord. It's telling her to make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Now, she tried making a highway in the desert once before, in the Exodus. A highway took 40 years to cross because it was so crooked. Went all around the wilderness, in circles, never got there. Learn from the past and make now a straight highway. Make straight. Every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill shall be made low. Who out of all the nations of the earth is in a better position to learn that lesson and say it? She who had been exalted, and out of her exaltation, because she waxed fat and kicked, she was made low. She who had been desolate among the nations, and out of that desolation has been brought back to being God's people again. Again, the forerunner of the experiences of the nations. The crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. Here he's talking Jacob's trouble. That's the code word when God fights for Israel. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The voice that cries. Now this is the voice telling Israel to say something. And he says, what shall I cry? And this is what Israel should learn. All flesh is grass. All the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. And the grass withers, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withers, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever. That's the contrast that Israel must learn in this second prophecy. Is the contrast to learn that all of our military might, all of our Moshe Dayans and our Yigal Yadins and all of our phantom jets in the United States are grass. And when the Spirit of the Lord blows upon that grass in these four winds, it will wither. It will fade. It will be like a city without walls. Learn that lesson, and that the one thing that will stand is the Word of the Lord. Now there is the one solid foundation. This is what puts peace into the message of comfort to Israel. This is what makes it a message that is not just comforting, but gives the long-range comfort to the kingdom. So going back to Ezekiel 37 then, we note that we have a prophecy of the regathering of Israel, a prophecy in general how their hopes, being dead, will be revived, but a prophecy how in its revival has been so specifically fulfilled in the events of the last 70 years, close to 100 years, now since this prophecy has begun.